This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by HelloFresh, the meal kit service that's dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. If you're trying to stop blowing all your money on takeout this year, but you're not up for the effort it takes to plan and make every single meal that you're going to need to eat in order to keep living, HelloFresh is here for you. For 50% off your first week of meals, go to HelloFresh.ca/TheImposter and enter Imposter at checkout. Canada land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Aaliyah Pabani. The first time I listened to Plantasia was a few years ago on YouTube. I think the algorithm found it for me because I almost exclusively go there for new agey ambient music that I can work to. The album's from 1976. On the cover, there's an illustration of two people kind of lightly embracing a potted plant, and the leaves are cupping their ears like headphones. They look totally blissed out. The cover says, "Warm earth music for plants and the people who love them." And it comes with a booklet for plant care. It starts with this kind of whimsical, synthy whistle that opens up into this encompassing, triumphal melody. There are these sweeping riffs that paint a picture of the world as a place where everything is dynamic and complex. It kind of reminds me of early nature films. There's this sense of wonderment that captures how plants are stimulating and alive on one register, like if you're watching them on a time lapse, and on another register, they're kind of like pieces of home decor, objects for serenity. If they're alive, it's easy to forget. Two weeks ago, someone in the YouTube comments wrote, "Who else panicked when the other link went down?" And 72 people liked it. And it's because people rely on that album the way that I had started to rely on it. One guy said that he listened to it every night at the end of his workday. It became a kind of ritual experience. It feels like a head massage. Up until recently, I didn't know that Plantasia was made by this guy from St. John, New Brunswick. Mort Garson was one of the first musicians to own a Moog synthesizer, and in the mid-60s, he used it to soundtrack the Apollo 11 moon landing. The sound of the synth became the de facto sound of space. So this is a bit embarrassing, but before I started looking into Mort Garson, I thought that a synthesizer was basically an electric piano. It's not. It's not like the electric guitar, which is about adding electricity to this instrument that already exists. With the synthesizer, the electricity is the only factor in shaping the sound. The first synthesizers looked more like telephone switchboard cabinets than instruments, and you played them with knobs and patch cords. So if you're like me, and you want to know more about this radical machine and how it was used to fabricate our ideas of space, check out the last episode. These days, basically any electronic device that can make sounds uses a synthesizer in chip form. But in the mid-60s, people had never heard these kinds of sounds before. For the early electronic pioneers who were using the synth, it seemed to break open the possibilities for what sound could do. And one of those things was communicating with plants. We'll get to why people were completely consumed by this desire a little later.
But Plantasia came out of that era, and Mort Garson's album for Plants was way ahead of its time. Here's this guy who grew up in St. John in the 1920s, went to Juilliard, wrote a hit single, and then moved to Beverly Hills where he did arrangements for huge names like Doris Day. And while he was knee-deep in commercial music, he also released a bunch of really weird synthesizer albums. There's this one that's got a song for every sign of the zodiac.
Six men and six trees waiting with purpose. Can build in time a house, a city.
This one's called Electronic Hair Pieces, and as the title suggests, it's electronic covers of songs from Hair the Musical. And then there's his final album, Plantasia, the one that was allegedly given away for free with the purchase of a Simmons mattress at Sears when it was released. I wanted to know everything there was to know about Mort Garson, but he died in 2008. And when I reached out to electronic musicians from that era and artists working in a similar vein now, I kept hearing things like this.
Mainly, I'm amazed I haven't run across Mort before.
To be honest, I haven't come across a lot of references to this album.
There's a wonderful little 5 or 6 minute thing where he switches from one sort of fairly straight ballad-type sound to a couple of dance forms. And the way he segues from one to the other is really cute. Cute is probably the wrong word, but it's it's good.
I really like the music. I have to say, like, it's very, like, optimistic sounding, you know, happy, and I think that kind of represents the time.
There's a real playfulness. This guy's having a really good time.
I wondered how someone could be so prolific, but also so unknown. Here's his daughter, Day Darme. She spoke to me from her catering business in San Francisco.
He had a very anything-goes kind of attitude. So if he woke up early in the morning and wanted to buy a car, he would wake my mom and I up, and we would leave immediately, and we would go and buy a brand-new car before the dealer even opened in our pajamas.
I was curious about what Mort's childhood was like in comparison. His parents were Russian-Jewish immigrants to St. John, and like a lot of Maritimers in the 30s and 40s, they moved to Brooklyn when he was still young. His grandfather sold steel, and there were more opportunities in New York, especially in the Russian Jewish immigrant community that they were part of. I asked Day if he had ever talked about his years in Canada, but Mort didn't really talk about his childhood that much.
He talked more about his parents leaving Russia and choosing Canada as the place that they would land, and how they were so happy to be freed from what was going to be happening there. And I think that he remembers it, the cold, and he remembers there was a certain kind of spatial freedom that he felt. And I think that he remembered the family felt very close and safe.
And was he playing music from a young age? Like, do you know the story of kind of how he got into it?
Yeah, I do. You know, nobody else in my father's family was musical, not one other person. And his parents bought a decorative piano. And my father was quite young, and he sat down and he just started playing. And they couldn't believe what he was playing, just like making it up. And they had him start taking piano young, 8 or 10. My mom's joke for my father used to be that he was like an idiot savant, which basically he knew music. To relax, he would lay down on a couch and he would read a book of music and hear it in his head. but he could not change a light bulb. No joke intended. So when my mother got together with my father was just a New York musician going from club to club and playing, and he loved all kinds of music. And that's, he just wanted to be playing music with people. And my mom told him, you need to get a job where you're making steady money, or you need to stop doing music. So he hooked up with Bob Hilliard, and, you know, he wrote a number one song.
That song was called Our Day Will Come, and it's been covered a bunch of times by artists like Katie Lang and Amy Winehouse.
Our day will come.
Family moved to Beverly Hills, and Mort became a kind of workhorse for Hollywood. Depending on what was needed, he could be the composer, the arranger, the orchestrator, the conductor, and sometimes the pianist. He worked on two Doris Day albums and arranged the Sandpipers' 1966 hit, Guantanamera. He was getting paid thousands of dollars making music for commercials.
And I think it was shortly after that, because he was already using the Moog synthesizer then, he was done with other people telling him how his music should sound. He felt that he had made enough money and made enough dent that he could go out and start doing what he really wanted to do as an artist.
And this is where things took a turn. If you look at Mort Garson's Wikipedia entry, there's an early career and a later career section, and they might as well be for different artists. And it's not necessarily only because Mort Garson took home the first commercially available synthesizer after seeing it at a trade show, but that definitely played a role.
You know, it didn't make any sense. This is way before computers and all of that. You know, he would take the patch cord and plug it up on the top and take a long patch cord and plug it in on the bottom. And then make the sound of a bird or, you know, who knows what. And he would explain some mathematics about it. I didn't get it, though. I just thought that he was a genius, that he could even, like, figure out how that worked. It was a little like the Wizard of Oz. At the time, we lived in Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles, and our house was completely surrounded by gardens, and my mom gardened, and so... So we had a studio with big glass wall, and it just looked out, you know, into this beautiful garden. So he would sit for hours with the synthesizer, and he would just listen to the sounds that it would make. And I think each time he came up with doing an album, it was something that would inspire him. That sound that it would make inspired him to think of plants and how would plants feel hearing that music and what would make them grow.
Imagine the synthesizer as a brand new instrument, but in the scientific sense. At the time, people were really excited about the idea of weather and how plants could communicate, and the synth opened up the possibility for people to connect with the natural world. And if there's a perceptual realm somewhere between humans and plants, that's where Mort was a lot of the time.
He would sit at the table and his fingers would be moving and his head would kind of be slightly bobbing, which basically meant he was sitting at the dinner table, but he was writing music. I would say stuff like "Dad, fingers," which meant that he was using his fingers as the keyboard and not really listening. And then he'd come back and, you know, when he was present, he was, you know, really present and fun, and I would say almost never in, you know, 80 years, almost never in a bad mood.
So how was Plantasia received when it was released?
He got a hit off of it. It was really well liked, and surprisingly, it's really well liked right now. I just recently have had this flurry of inquiries to use pieces of Plantasia for commercials, of which I did give the go-ahead for 1 year for certain songs.
Plantasia is having a bit of a revival, but a lot of people might have heard it before without even realizing it. That's the song Zelda's Lullaby from The Legend of Zelda. It was inspired by this song from Plantasia. After Mort's death in 2008, Plantasia got posted online, and suddenly there were all these articles about it on various music blogs. The CD is available used on Amazon for $156, and there are two copies left. I wanted to know what Day had to say about it.
I don't listen to it. I don't really like it. I haven't listened to it in so many hundreds of years. But I think as a child, you know, teenager and even in my 20s, I didn't really understand it. It was too bizarre for me. It was too off the beaten track. But it's probably just not my style music.
It's interesting to me to think that, like, the child of kind of one of these really big, like, electronic musicians is still like, that was a bit wacky, Dad. Like, Dad released a wacky album and I wasn't a big fan.
It is kind of like that. It's like, you know, and it kind of, you know, and I will listen to it again because it also could just go back to my semi-embarrassment of that my parents were not normal. I mean, when I listened to them and I used to think that it sounded like people would be sitting around doing, like, smoking, you know, opium.
One of the hardest things about going out in the winter is that you're leaving your warm house for a large cold room with sticky floors. And I understand why that is. If you own a venue, spending tons of money on decor to create this spectacular environment that you'll be stuffing in a dumpster the next morning seems less than ideal. But there's a workaround, and it's a paper art party called Pulp. On January 20th, Pulp is going to transform Toronto's Super Wonder Gallery into a Bluebin playground. This year, the party's going to feature a cloud made out of plastic and outfits made out of used maps. There's going to be live performances by A Little Rambunctious and Alex Bartosik in the early evening, and then you can stay late to dance to music by DJs Ebony and Wasserman. The best thing about this party is that Pulp is a nonprofit, and the proceeds go to Evergreen Center for Street-Involved Youth, and those youth actually help make the art for the party. So if you're looking for something worth leaving the house for on January 20th and you also want to support a really good cause, get a ticket for Pulp. Listeners of The Imposter get 10% off the ticket price. And to do that, you just have to go to pulpartparty.ca and use the promo code IMPOSTER. That's pulpartparty.ca, promo code IMPOSTER. Okay, so it's the new year, and maybe you're one of these people who thinks that the first day of the Gregorian calendar is utterly meaningless. And you feel like you need to tell everyone, like some sort of Twitter prophet, to remind people that they're stupid for caring about it at all. I'm looking at you, Neil deGrasse Tyson. But the thing is, even though the new year isn't astronomically significant, Neil, it's still a time where you can think back to everything you remember doing and decide whether you want to change it up. And if that change has anything to do with eating healthier meals, not having a ton of rotting produce in your fridge every week, or learning how to cook, HelloFresh might be your thing.
Every week, HelloFresh comes up with new tasty recipes that are made for people who have about 30 minutes to cook dinner. And the meals do not look or taste like things that took 30 minutes to make. They're things like hearty vegetable shepherd's pie with roasted broccoli and panko-crusted chicken with sweet potato, cranberry, and arugula salad. HelloFresh delivers a week's worth of meals to your doorstep in this big refrigerated box, and everything is already prepped and portioned to the exact amount you need, so there's no food waste. And the great thing is, there's no commitment, so you can actually cancel at any time. If you just want to try this thing out for a week, you can get 50% off your first box by going to hellofresh.ca/theimposter. And that works out to about $5 or $6 a meal, so if this is something that you're curious about in any way, you have no excuse not to try it out for a week. Go to hellofresh.ca/theimposter.
First lead that comes in is just so silky. All of Mort Garson's drum machines sound sort of foreign to me, where you can't really tell what drum machine it is. It just sounds like weird little synthy bits that are sort of pieced together. My favorite part about Ode to an African Violet is when that bass drops, though, because it sort of seems to build up to that, and then that bass drop is just so good. The first time that I had a real Mort Garson experience, I was at this point in my life where I was listening to like a lot of Kraftwerk and different kinds of electronic music like that, but I'd never heard anything like Mort Garson's music, where it's very sort of thought out and composed, and it has that silly Moog edge that I really like in lounge and exotica. I just never heard synthesizers being used in such a delightful and concise way.
That's Jess Forrest, who makes music as Castleif. She shares a small studio apartment with several synthesizers and about 30 houseplants.
One of my favorite plants is called a maidenhair fern. And they're really, really beautiful. They have these very tiny, delicate leaves on extremely thin black stalks that look like a tiny black piece of hair. And they need to be misted several times a day. They need to be watered every day. And if you don't do it, they will die.
Her new album is called Plant Material. The album's dedicated to her houseplants, and it was inspired by Mort Garson's Plantasia. When she talked about her influences, I realized that plant music was kind of a genre.
Plantasia wasn't just a Mort Garson thing. It was a 70s thing. It was a thing that happened. I have a couple of Music for Plants albums, and they're not very good. But they're funny. And then I read this book, The Secret Life of Plants, that's sort of about the feelings of plants and sort of plants. There's a big chapter on plants' relation to music, and my obsession with synthesizers and plants is just, I just had to do it.
That book she's talking about, it was a big deal in the 70s. It was a New York Times bestseller big deal. The book was an account of experiments with plants that proved that they were sentient beings with secret inner lives. One of them involved hooking a plant up to a polygraph machine
to see if it would register a stress signal if the experimenter just imagined setting it on fire. If that one sounds very obviously pseudoscientific, what about the idea that plants grow better with classical music? That's also in the book, and honestly, I didn't really think of questioning that. The book was so popular that they made it into a movie, and Stevie Wonder did the soundtrack.
A scene familiar in any kitchen takes on special importance in this experiment.
Володя, переключи задание по всем параметрам.
So my favorite scene in the film is when this cabbage is being chopped up in front of another cabbage, and behind the cabbage, the witness cabbage, there's like a screen showing, you know, digital line kind of going crazy when the cabbage sees the other cabbage get chopped. And then they also show this moment where like they want to prove that the cabbage not only, you know, feels empathy for his fellow cabbage, but also that the cabbage can identify the assailant. So they have this like lineup of people walk through, and when the person who had been doing the chopping walks past the witness cabbage, then it also like reacts.
That's Amanda White. She's a visual artist who's doing a PhD in critical plant studies. She's interested in creating these experiences where people can approach plants differently than they do in their everyday lives. Amanda did this one piece called Breathing Room. She filled up a warped Buckminster Fuller-like geodesic dome with enough plants to create oxygen for one human to be able to breathe. And if you're wondering, it's 350 to 500 plants depending on their size, or 17 trees. Her work encourages people to look at the way they look at plants, and I wanted to hear her thoughts on the kind of new agey art about plants that came out of the 70s.
I am aware that there was a sort of surge of interest in plants during that time that I think it coincides with a lot of environmental movements and back to the land movement kind of 1970s. So plants became interesting, likely for the same reason they're interesting now, in that, you know, we're trying to like recreate a relationship with the natural world.
The problem with trying to recreate that relationship is that you run the risk of fashioning it in your own image. Because of the exaggerated claims that plants could read minds or that they had specific tastes in music, scientists have been stigmatized for their research about the ways that plants actually respond to sound. For example, plants will release a chemical to protect themselves just from someone playing them the sound of an insect chewing.
But looking at something like The Secret Life of Plants, you know, when I see that film, I know at the time it was presented as this kind of scientific evidence that plants are emotional beings similar to us. But when I look at that film, I kind of see that as art. And I don't think people are going to experience art, a piece of art necessarily to change their worldview. But, it, you know, because there's like an emotional aspect to experiencing artwork, if you can combine that sort of like emotional response with some kind of ecological, you know, issue, then you can create something that might speak to people on a different level.
Amanda also has a bunch of houseplants, and she was concerned that potted plants are cut off from communicating with other plants through their root systems. So she created Plant Radio for Plants, a pirate radio station where outdoor plants were broadcast to her indoor plants. And even though Amanda couldn't hear the communication taking place, she thought it was important to set up the system. So instead of creating music for plants to listen to,
it kind of twists that story a little bit about what plants are listening to and acknowledges that they do potentially have this like secret life, but that it's not really overlapping with ours. Like they're not listening to our music, but they're listening to something.
listen to Mort Garson's music now, I hear it differently. It's still got that kind of odd playfulness to it, but it's hard to listen to the music without hearing the faith people had in the synthesizer. That its sounds could somehow define outer space or communicate with nature. But the truth of it is that there isn't any sound in outer space, at least, not that we can hear. And it's still not clear whether plants are actually listening, at least not in the way that we can. The sound of the synth is actually about that human desire to create something new that'll get us a little closer to the things we can't fully understand. When we try to synthesize something out of nothing, all we're really hearing is ourselves. Amanda White, who can no longer chop cabbage the way you chop cabbage. Castle If, who swears this is the last maiden hair fern that she's gonna kill. And Daydar May, whose dad couldn't change a light bulb. You can find links to the music you heard and the art that you couldn't see by going to canadalandshow.com/imp. This episode of The Imposter was produced by Angela Shackle and I, and our theme music is by Nathan Burley. You can follow us on Twitter at Impster, that's I-M-P-S-T-R, and you can follow me at Aaliyah Pabani. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand, and if you like The Imposter, tell your people about it.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.